The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to help support the show and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a quest to discover the entertainment that has changed the lives of LGBTQ folks. My guest this week is the legendary performer Peppermint, star of stage and screen from Drag Race to Pose to Broadway. Her new album, A Girl Like Me, comes out this week, featuring autobiographical songs about a turbulent relationship, along with a steamy music video called Good Sex. And she's got some live streams and fundraisers and election events in the works as well. A very busy lady. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook, where I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on October 24 at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's a nice, relaxing time to just hang out and chat. There's a link to that at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And don't forget to check out my other shows. Culture Cruise on YouTube is a deep dive into queer entertainment milestones. I just posted a video about the 90s show Dinosaurs, and its unlikely link to a real-life gay Transylvanian dinosaur hunter from the 1800s. Just search YouTube for Culture Cruise. Now, here's Peppermint. Well, this week I'm speaking to, from New York City, it's Peppermint. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
I mean, there was a couple, to be honest with you. But the first one is Poetic Justice, the movie starring Janet Jackson. Hmm. And then the second is Janet Jackson's subsequent album, which released the same year, the Janet album. They kind of were part of the same like feeling and vibe. Just her sexual liberation and freedom. It was very new and different for fans of Janet. And it really did show me a different side of sexuality that was kind of like this non-threatening sexuality, you know, kind of thing, but still very strong. And so that was when I pretty much knew I was Janet Jackson.
How did that manifest? Like, how did you start identifying with it? Like, did you start like dressing or performing?
Well, I was a camp counselor in Delaware, where I grew up, and I started, I was basically in charge of the class called Expressive Arts, which was basically dance class, performing arts club at camp. And I was the lead counselor, and I was the one in charge of what all the kids were going to do. And honey, you know, if you were in that class for the few years that I was teaching it, you knew every Janet Jackson dance routine that came out during that time, period.
So did you get a reputation as the Janet person, like the one who always knew like every song, every dance?
Pretty much, yes.
Can you describe, like, for folks who like somehow are not familiar with her work, like, what is the appeal? Like, you know, how do you sell people on Janet? Like, what caught your eye?
I just saw someone being a strong woman who was she was definitely using her sexuality to communicate, right? But there was just something really classy about her. It's really difficult for me to put into the most crystallized words, but I just, you know, there's something about her that really attracted me, and I wanted to be, you know, doing the things that she was doing.
Do you have a favorite video from that time?
If, by Janet Jackson, yes.
Okay, describe what's happening on screen and what you love in that song.
Well, the song is basically about, I guess, an almost casual encounter, a near miss, two people attracted to each other, kind of fantasizing about what would happen if they actually did have that, you know, fantasy encounter. And it's sung from Janet's perspective, and the chorus is, if I was your girl, all the things I would do to you. I'd make you call out my name and ask who it belongs to. So it's obviously very direct. And the video is, there's two versions of the video, an all-dance version, which obviously if you're a Jackson, I guess you're going to have some dance moves. But the original version of the video takes place in a sort of a nightclub, a futuristic at the time, interactive video, sort of nightclub with a very sexy edge where people are basically hooking up. It's like Tinder in real life. That's how I would probably explain it. There's video screens. People are, you know, there's voyeuristic, you know, people are looking at each other from across the room or in a different part of the club on the video screen and sort of communicating, choosing each other, who they're going to go into the back with. It's very adult, but it's presented in it's not that graphic. It's a dance video, But certainly at the time, it was like, oh, they're going to go have sex. Like, that was, you know, what you would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not leaving a lot to the up to interpretation. Like, oh, maybe they're just going to be good friends.
Yeah, they're going to go play cards in the back.
And it's got, like, one of the lovely things about that song is it's got that sort of fantasy element to it, where she's, like, talking about, like, that if of this isn't the case now, but I want it to be, and here's what I imagine that could be.
Yeah, exactly.
Surprisingly, for something that's so, like you said, like, pretty adult and sexual, it's also got a nice romantic kind of tenderness.
I really do think so. And maybe that's what makes it not feel quite like, you know, another video that came out around the time, Madonna's Erotica.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting contrast between those two.
Mm-hmm.
How into dance were you at that time? Like, how much was it just a part of your life?
I was into dance a lot. I mean, I certainly wasn't. It wasn't important for me to, like, go to dance school at the time and become, you know, a prima ballerina or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was into dance as a mode during, like, of pop music, as it pertained to pop music and pop videos. So the dance that I was really into was music video dance, dance at award shows, things like that.
Did you think of yourself as a performer?
Yeah. No, I didn't think of myself as a performer. I kind of just was. Even before, I mean, thinking of myself as a performer would mean I would like to do the job of a performer to get paid a paycheck to be a performer. I think I just felt good being on stage in front of people. And I didn't know how I thought of myself.
Yeah. So you mentioned that summer camp. What were the other, like, performing opportunities that you had when you were young?
Choir to band. When, you know, many, many of the opportunities were in school. Choir, band, things like that.
You looking ahead to, like, your future life, like, what did you envision?
I didn't really have much of a vision for the future. There wasn't really a plan. I didn't say, it would be great if I could say, oh, I knew if I joined band that I'd be sitting here having this podcast with you. I just really, really just enjoyed it. I can't, you know, I mean, that's one of the great things about human joy is that there is no explanation, but we all understand that it makes us feel great.
You know, I think people think of you now as a community leader and a role model and a creative, you know, somebody that they look up to. Was that a position that you had, like, in high school? Like, were you sort of an instigator of creative projects?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, when it comes to, you know, I certainly didn't know that I'd be marching for transgender rights, but I was always a bit of a producer. I remember organizing the neighborhood kids to, participate in my version of A Wizard of Oz when I was younger.
Oh, please tell me about what that was like.
Of course, I was obsessed with the movie. And then I just asked the neighborhood kids. I was like, hey, come on over. We're going to do The Wizard of Oz. And I didn't know what that meant. But I brought the kids to my mom's closet and got them some dressed up. And we put yellow bricks in the middle of the street, in the middle of the house. And then we sat down and watched Wizard of Oz.
That's so charming. It's like a little costume party. And then I guess everybody in tribute to the movie. Did you have other, you know, aside from Janet, obsessions around that time?
No, that was my main obsession.
So that was your focus. And it sounds like you didn't feel like there was a destiny for you. Like, I got to be up on stage, my name in lights. But it somehow that has happened. So
it didn't even occur to me that one could get paid to be an actor until I was probably looking for colleges to attend.
What were you looking for? Like, when you started doing that college search?
I was, you know, looking for college because everyone had to go to college. You had to take SATs. And, you know, when you're in high school, the pressure is what college you're going to go to. So I was looking for college.
Was there something in particular, or was it just like, well, I'll go and I'll figure it out when I get there?
Well, no. I mean, I knew that I was in 12th grade and I knew that I had to do something after that. And my mom was going to kick me out when I was 18. So I needed to go to any college. And so I started looking at all the colleges, like, in the area. And then eventually I was like, well, I don't like math. And the notion of going to college for a specialty was not in my mind. It was just basically I was looking for grade 13, if that makes sense. But in that search, I started discovering that there were colleges that focused on musical theater performance. And I was like, well, I'd rather go to that grade 13 than the University of whatever.
Yeah. So tell me about, like, what grade 13 wound up being like for you. What did you discover?
Well, I've moved to New York City and I discovered the city. Grade 13 was really just an infatuation with New York City. which had, you know, offered so much. Anyone who has ever heard the words New York City knows that the city offers an abundance. And so it did. And I was able to take advantage of all those things. Nightclubs, queer people, colorful people, you know, a city that was open late, all that stuff. It was great. In addition to my college studies.
Did you discover performers and forms of entertainment and stuff like that that you just never had imagined before?
Well, I think I knew that those people existed. I'd certainly seen, by the time I was a college student, I'd heard of, you know, gay clubs and drag performers. So it's not like I was like, whoa, what's that? But I just, you know, the personalities that I ran into, that was the discovery. But the fact that queer people existed was not like some, you know, something that shocked me.
How did the queer community, I like, even knowing that it exists, how did it compare the, you know, the Delaware queer community to the what you found in New York?
Well, it was just certainly a lot more of them. One of the biggest differences is that, you know, people in New York weren't necessarily all dating each other, at least in my circles. Back where I grew up, you know, everyone was just kind of, there was less folks, less people that were out. So you would end up dating your ex again because that's who was like around. But otherwise, the difference between the two, you know, was certainly a lot more diverse and just more people, an abundance of people. And it wasn't so enclosed. There was, even though there were many parts of the community that were and are still segregated, day and time that I was coming up in the clubs, it was all about the big nightclubs, and those were attracting everyone. Queer people, queer-centric people, hetero people, whoever.
Can you describe that scene for, like, folks who haven't been there? Like, what was that nightclub scene like?
Yeah, it was like an adult candy store where everyone was invited, and anyone who had a problem with anyone based on their race, gender, or class would get ejected.
What could you experience? Like, when you walk through the door, what do you see?
You see colorful people in costumes. You know, this was the 90s. You know, metallics were in, metallic lipstick, metallic pants, metallic clothing, oversized jeans, glow sticks, you know, watch the movie Party Monster, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, you're really painting a vivid portrait. I was in Boston around that time, and certainly no New York, but still, like, I remember the fashion and the vibe and the music. Yeah, so were you, like, in the nightclubs, were you performing at that point?
Yeah. I started performing pretty much right away.
What kind of songs did you do?
I mostly did R&B songs, and then, of course, the occasional club dance song. You needed to do that if you were in a club.
And what was you said that the community was a lot more, it sounds like, just vast, that there were more people to meet. And did you come to New York feeling like, you know, you were looking for a queer community, or is that just something that you happened
yes,
to find?
Yes, I wanted to be around more of my own people. I didn't know what that was, but that's what I was, you know, maybe there's something inside my subconscious knew was my compass.
Did you have, like, little indicators, like you're on the right track?
No, my subconscious was my compass. So when I, you know, I think anyone, it's just called Gaydar, I guess. I don't know.
It just, like, it sounds like there was a crowd of people and a social scene that just felt right. What were you doing, like, in college? Like, were you starting to get a sense of, like, what your career would be and what you actually wanted to do beyond just, like, you know, well, I'm going to college now. I guess that's the next thing to do.
No, I didn't really have that much of a goal. I mean, at that point, I was going to school for musical theater performance. And so the next step that made sense would have been, you know, maybe Broadway. And so I didn't, that's what I was focused on during the time that I was in high school. And I was getting paid to do drag, but that certainly didn't seem like a, you know, there wasn't even such a thing as RuPaul's Drag Race. And there weren't that many drag queens that were, you know, living the life as a celebrity. And so it really was just, you know, I work in the clubs at night while I'm in school. And maybe one day I'll get cast on a Broadway show. That's where my mind was.
Were you interested in Broadway?
Well, I was in school for Broadway.
But was it because you know, that's just what a performer has to do in New York? Or was that something that you were actually, like, excited or enthusiastic for?
I think I was definitely excited and enthusiastic for any type of stage. At a certain point in a performer's life, you can't really choose your stage. You just feel compelled to get on whatever stage is there. And so I think that's where I was. These days, it's a little bit different. But back then, I was just happy to be on any stage, whether it would be in the back or in the front or on a Broadway or maybe as an extra on a TV set as an 18-year-old young college student, any of that would have been great.
Did you have any shows that you were in that you particularly loved?
Well, I wasn't really in any shows while I was in college, but I was hungry for the opportunity to do it. I was really excited to be in the nightclub performing because I didn't have to turn in a term paper with it, right? Mm-hmm. I was just on stage living my free life.
Well, I'm sure you're still like getting evaluated. It's just a very different kind of, you know, from a live audience right in front of you.
That's none of my business. Maybe. Really none of my business or concern.
What does it feel like to be up on stage and have like just a crowd cheering for you?
I think it feels, like a connection. It feels good is what it feels like. And it feels like you're connected with people. There's certainly an energy. Anyone that's ever been in a room with your family or anyone with other people knows what energy feels like when you're around other people. And you certainly know what bad energy feels like. And you know what good energy feels like. And being on stage with people clapping is good energy.
After college, did you just dive like further into drag and performance and being at the clubs? Or were there other like opportunities or paths open to you?
After college, I, you know, started looking for temp jobs, different things that I would feel comfortable in. Obviously, I wasn't going to apply to be an accountant. And so I was just looking for jobs that would be easy for me to get into that might be flexible. I was still working in the nightclubs and wasn't paying that much money, but I was making ends meet while I was looking during the day. At one point at that time, it certainly felt like what I needed was a day job. And so that's what I went for. So I've held different ones. I was a makeup artist. I was a bartender. I worked as a receptionist, you know, at Sony Music. And those were all nice jobs. I don't think I was at any of them for more than, you know, for 6 months. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's the story of the actor in New York who, you know, has the day job, but also, you know, has the dream, right?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if it's that romantic. I just hated these jobs.
Mm. I mean, that is that's certainly fair. Like you've got like on one hand at night you go up on stage and people are like screaming and clapping for you. Probably hard for that to compare to being a receptionist.
Maybe. But I mean, they were really in two different. They were apples and oranges. I mean, I guess if I weren't a performer, I would think, wow, I see myself on TV. I'm going to have a psychic pathway to that. And that's what I'm going to do. And then when you do it, it feels very fulfilling. And I think people like to sort of fantasize that that's the way it happens, but sometimes it's not. Especially for someone like me, the path wasn't quite so clear. If I was born cisgender, female, blonde, white, and blue-eyed, then, you know, saying I'm going to be president one day is probably very fulfillable. But, you know, being a Black person who's queer, those paths are not quite as fulfillable. And even if they are, there's a whole lot of barriers, many of which you don't even see. And so, no, I didn't have a dream of that because there really wasn't any examples of that to lead me. I just knew that I needed to pay my rent. And I worked at a bar, worked at a club, and I worked at this. And some of them I liked and some of them I didn't. And certainly the ones that allowed me more freedom, where I could wear nail polish and crazy hair, were the ones that I gravitated to. The ones that were like, you need to dress like a business casual as loose as it gets. Naturally, for someone who's a creative, those were not really, you know, that didn't turn me on. I wasn't excited to put on khakis and go sit in front of a computer. And that's just me because I'm a creative and that's not what turned me on. But it was what I had to get up and do to go pay the bills. Now, I didn't know that I was going to be on Broadway or even on any TV show. Again, RuPaul's Drag Race didn't even exist. And so at that time, doing drag was really, it wasn't my dream, but it was where I felt safe. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. That you could be a little bit more of yourself in certain contexts.
Yeah.
Did you think of yourself, and let me know if this is too personal, but did you think of yourself as a trans woman at that time?
No, I just thought of myself as a woman.
Is that something that you were open and out about with other people?
Yeah. I certainly wasn't under any sort of, you know, delusions. I knew that I was born assigned male and that I needed to use the boys' room when I went to the bathroom if I was in public. But in terms of my social life, it was very much, it was very similar to what it is like now. Who I related to, who I was gravitating to, who gravitated towards me. In terms of the terminology, the terminology was a lot different even 5 or 10 years ago. And so I didn't necessarily have all, certainly everyone, many people realize that the terminology when it comes to gender has changed drastically in the past 3 years. So let alone in the past 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it was just a completely different world. But I was, for all intents and purposes, the same woman then as I am now. I didn't really know what my path was going to be with regards to gender or how I was going to express that. But I knew that I was always this woman.
Yeah, and I imagine it might have been hard, or maybe correct me if I'm wrong, that to find role models of Black trans women role models in media.
Yeah, there weren't any.
I can understand why Janet Jackson might have been like an important figure, because at least there's a woman who's a performer who's successful and powerful. Did you feel as though you're sort of like charting your own course there without role models to look up to at that time?
Yeah, and I didn't even know that it was a course. I just felt like I was living, I was trying to have new experiences. I think that's how like 18, 19, 20-year-olds are navigate the world, or they're just, I want to have as many experiences as possible. They don't know that they're actually blazing a trail or charting their own path. They're just having experiences.
You're learning from yourself, basically. Like if there's no one there showing you the ropes and being like, okay, here's how you can be, that you're like, well, I'm just going to try it out myself and see what works.
Yeah.
But before you got like the national attention with Drag Race, what did people know your onstage persona? Like how did audiences know you at that time?
Before Drag Race, I had been working by the time Drag Race started, I had been working for years. 10 years had gone by of me working in, about 5 or 10 years, depending, had gone by of me working in the clubs. As the years went on, I worked more and more in the clubs. And so eventually I was just working in clubs, making a name as you would, it is a community. It's not just an industry. These are other humans, people that you see on a weekly basis, people that you form relationships with. And naturally, when you form a rapport with that person as a coworker, as a colleague, then you start to earn a reputation. And so that's what it felt like for me. But maybe to the person that was visiting New York for the first time in their life, they're like, oh, that person's making waves. I was really just building relationships. And I think that's what life is all about, just building relationships with people.
What was your, did you have inspirations beyond, you mentioned Janet, but for the Peppermint persona that when you get up on stage and you're on before an audience, who inspired you?
Well, I was definitely inspired by the other drag performers that I worked with and knew in New York City. Many of them that came before me, Lady Bunny, Mistress Formica, Sherry Vine, those were the people that I knew of before I started working in the clubs, and then obviously met and worked with once I did work in the clubs. And so those are the people locally that were inspiring. Of course, I still loved Janet Jackson, but these people were people that I could actually learn from. They became mentors.
What did you learn from them?
Just professionalism.
As someone who's like an up-and-comer, was it exciting to work alongside these folks who were sort of, established icons in the scene?
Yeah, it definitely was. It was surreal for a little bit to work with people whose reputations preceded them and you knew who they were. And then get very quickly, that kind of wears off when you get to, know them for who they really are. I guess the wearing off is your projection of who you think they are or should be starts to break down, and give way to who they really are.
Mm. So you're developing these colleagues and this like professional rapport with everybody, and Drag Race is sort of happening and becoming a phenomenon. What made you decide to audition, to send in a tape?
And I would imagine in any field, the better you perform in your job, the more opportunities you get, opportunities and responsibilities. And so the same thing was happening in the nightclubs. I was having more opportunities to perform, travel a bit and, just start to expand a little bit, getting my own show as opposed to being a guest in someone else's show, things mm-hmm. like that. As that was basically multiplying on its own. And it felt like it was perpetuating itself. But then eventually, after a few seasons of Drag Race, I realized that one of the prerequisites seemingly to getting new work was having been on Drag Race.
Yeah. So you must have been doing something right, be blowing up and getting bigger and traveling. And what do you think like people were seeing in your act? Like what was drawing people into your performances that you were getting so big?
people tell me that they really liked the vibe of the tone that I set in the room while I was performing and relating with everyone.
Okay. And then it seems like from there, the next logical step is, all right, I got to keep growing, got to keep getting bigger. And Drag Race was it?
Yeah. It wasn't about a target or a goal of being the one thing or another. It was really about just the next step and how to make ends meet. I wasn't able to continue to have new experiences or pay the bills. And so it just felt like if you can't beat them, join them. And so I auditioned for the show.
Do you remember getting the call that you had made the cut?
I do. I thought it was a friend of mine, and it turned out to be one of the producers.
Where were you when you got that call?
In my bed.
So you picked up the phone, you thought it was a friend, and you get this potentially life-changing news.
Mm-hmm.
What was going through your head, like, after you got that call, and you're like, okay, things are possibly going to change a lot for me. Like, what were you thinking?
That things were going to change a lot for me, and the first thing I did was call the friend that I thought it was. Just to scream and share the news.
What was your expectation? What did you think was going to, you know, happen, I guess, in the next month, in the next year, following that call?
I didn't really know. I was kind of along for the ride. It was really difficult to kind of speculate. I knew that I was going to pack my bags and go and film a show. I knew that it was going to be similar to what I saw on TV. I knew that I would be a part of a group of people who were associated with the show. And those are all, like, logical things that I knew was obviously going to happen. Anything outside of that, I didn't really want to speculate on. I didn't allow myself to speculate on. I also knew that there was a chance that I would probably earn more money then than I had been prior. But I mean, again, I was living in New York City, one of the most expensive cities to live in the country. And the only way that I was able to earn money was doing this job that I happened to really love. But it was very difficult to do. And I had to do a lot of it, work 7 days a week, practically. The only alternative for many of the people like me, other Black trans women, is sex work. And so I knew that I didn't want to go into that. And so it was really about, how do I earn money to pay the next rent? Because right now the bank is empty.
What was your experience like doing Drag Race? Did you find yourself still, like, coming out of that feeling like, I still love this work? Or did that change the way you looked at the performance that you did?
It didn't change how I felt about my performance. It definitely enlightened me to the world of reality TV. I didn't really know much about how it worked before that.
Did you come out of that feeling, like, wiser and like, okay, here are the things that I wish I had known going in?
Slightly, but I mean, I really did a personal transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Many people who go on to experience things like that have this sudden growth spurt where they become aware of, you know, self-aware in a different way. But being someone who's a little bit more seasoned, who went to the show, came to the show pretty fully seasoned, I was really happy that I focused on staying true and to myself and kind of using the same tactics that while taping the show that I used to use while performing at the clubs. Just being a good, honest person and communicating and making sure that the vibe is good in the room. And that's what I did on set. And I think that's what came across.
Did you find yourself, like, changed at all by the experience? Or I guess maybe another question is, like, what changed afterwards? Like, did you find that it was successful at getting you to the next level and getting you better gigs?
It definitely was. And that's what I'm thankful for.
Did you find, like, bigger crowds and better venues?
They were mostly, you know, for a good year, they were mostly all of the clubs. Instead of just the clubs in New York, it was pretty much the clubs in the whole country. It was exciting, but it was really exhausting because they were just back to back. And so there was, you know, maybe a few hours of sleep, you know, sandwiched in between travel and performing.
So, I mean, that must have been exhausting in a very different way from, you know, having to work 7 days a week to make ends meet. But still, like, a lot of demand on your time.
Oh, yeah. A lot of demand on my time and body.
Were you looking forward to getting a break at the end of that? Or were you just, like, fully in on how busy you were?
I was fully in. And I said, let's just keep it, burn it till it burns.
Tell me about the kinds of performances you did. And, like, were you still very inspired by Janet while you were on that, you know, touring the country?
I mean, I will never not be inspired by Janet. But I didn't necessarily, I wasn't an impersonator. So it's not like I was, you know, trying to imitate her performances and my performances. I think it was just really her vibe. Vibe is a big theme with me. That was just what I would bring, and it was inspirational to me privately, but and it probably influenced some of my earlier choices in performing. But for the most part, you know, it's just I am who I am now. And, you know, the things I've seen and done as a youngster aren't necessarily what I talk about every day, but they inspired who I am. And now I make a certain caliber of choices because of those early inspirations, like Janet Jackson. But now it's Peppermint.
Do you have any, like, shows or appearances from, like, your post-Drag Race career that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, I did a Broadway show, and I was really proud of that.
Yeah, tell me more about that. That was pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah, Head Over Heels. It was a Go-Go's inspired musical about Sir Philip Sidney's Arcadia, basically a play about a story about utopia. And I played Pythio, the non-binary oracle, who was urging the protagonists to change their ways and become more open-minded. And that's the character, that's the story. And I was very fortunate to be cast in it. And apparently it was the first time an out trans woman had ever been cast in a leading role in a Broadway musical. And it was a wonderful experience. I'd done theater before. I have a theater background. I went to school for theater. It was very familiar to me, but obviously my first time on Broadway. It was great being part of the Broadway community.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that you went to school for, and it must have been just a kind of a part of your life living in New York for so long. Did you feel like you'd hit some sort of milestone or, like, personal or professional goal once you, like, were actually, like, there on Broadway?
It definitely felt like an achievement. People were talking about it in such a historic nature, so it would have been really kind of flippant and obtuse for me to not understand the impact. Mm-hmm. I understood that people were saying that this was an historic moment, and I treated it with reverence.
Were you getting a sense for, like, the kind of performance that you like? Because you'd done reality, you'd done Broadway, you were on TV, or you're, like, as an actor. Like, what were the?
I think my two favorites at this point are musical performances, my own music, original music, and and being on film and television. Those are my two favorites, which I'm really excited about my new album, A Girl Like Me, Letters to My Lovers. It's rare for me, and it's the first time I've ever been able to present something that is 100% honestly me.
Yeah, let's talk about the music. So we're talking just as you're releasing the music video for your song Best Sex, which, you know, watching it, I certainly can see, like, the Janet Jackson vibe.
Great. Yeah, then there you go.
Tell me about the creation of that album.
The creation of the album was, really just the bringing to life of my personal diary. I was in a relationship for about a year, and it was honestly one of the best relationships I'd been in up to that point. But when we broke up, it was obviously very devastating, and I wrote all my feelings down in a journal. And later on, when I was able to bear it, I put that journal to music. I partnered with my producing partners and writing partners that I'd worked with before. And we started working on the music, which took us about a year to complete. It's about 17 songs, which is a lot for one album. And so we decided to line them up in order of beginning, middle, and end of the relationship. And separate them into three EPs, which represent the beginning, the middle, and end. And we're going to release them over the course of the next year, the first of which comes out this week on the 16th of October, which is the beginning of the relationship, obviously. The first EP called A Girl Like Me, Letters to My Lovers.
Okay, yeah. So it's autobiographical, and I love how you're, like, telling the story and letting this, like, basically this epic relationship story unfold over time. It feels a lot like... like a serial TV show.
Oh, good. Maybe we'll get a deal. We did shoot in addition to the music video Best Sex for the first single that's out, which, by the way, there was a lot of Janet Jackson inspiration. We did go back and reference some of Janet's sexier moments, primarily the music video for Anytime, Anyplace, if anybody's ever seen that. There's an infamous shower scene that we kind of, you know, were heavily inspired by. It's the most naked I've ever been in a music video. And and most sexual I've ever been on camera. And so I was quite nervous, but I felt like I was in good hands with our director, April Maxey, our production, and everyone around. Of course, you know, it's worth noting that we did it very, we were being very careful to follow the latest COVID protocol. So everyone was wearing masks, who wasn't on camera, everyone's getting tested, and we were quarantining. So that made me feel more comfortable, because that is a certain layer filming during COVID. But in any event, we not only filmed that music video, we filmed a short film, which is shares the same title as the album. And it's basically brings to life a lot of the moments that you can't really sing about, the in-between moments. And that, coupled with the music of the album, which scores the film, hopefully it'll be a nice snapshot into the past year of my life.
Did this feel like, you said it was more sexual than you've been on camera in the past. Did this feel like, in any way, like taking a risk, opening up to the extent that you are?
Yes and no. I think something feels like a risk when you are not fully invested in it. And then it just sort of feels like you are compelled to do it. If it feels honest and truthful, then it doesn't feel like a risk. I think it feels like I'm compelled to do this because I'm passionate about it and I'm going to do it. The choice has already been made. And then there's people's reaction. So it feels less like a risk and more like putting myself out there for people to react. And that's something different. But I'm less concerned with their reaction because it's a very truthful and honest moment.
That's such an interesting way to look at it, that if I understand you, that it's not risky. If you're committed and you've decided that you're going to do this is what you're doing, it's so interesting to hear that, like, you don't feel risky about that. Like, you don't feel like you're taking a chance because you know that you're getting what you want out of it? Is that why it feels, I don't know, maybe not safe?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we also did it with, trying to be as tasteful as possible, technically. I mean, it's not like it's a porno. You know, we're not, like, actually having sex on camera. Not that porn is distasteful, but certainly you are at risk of having your accounts flagged, having the video taken down, things like that. But if you're not talking about just, am I worried about having the video taken down? If you're asking, am I worried about people's reactions? No, I'm showing a loving relationship on camera, that's my goal. My goal is to portray loving relationships between, for queer people, but particularly trans people and their partners. So we can destigmatize that. And if showing that is a risk, then so be it. Then the people who think it's a risk need to change. I'm human and I deserve love, and I deserve to express my love in a healthy and respectful manner. And I deserve to receive it in that way. I don't deserve for my love to have to be hidden or out in the shadows or something that's so taboo. You know, I'm human. And I eat, I sleep, I breathe. And all of those things are worthy of their place next to anyone else who eats, sleeps, and breathes. And I've seen a lot of other people eating and sleeping and breathing in front of my face on film and television. I've seen all types of, you know, people having their relationships and cisgender, heterosexual relationships. We've grown up with that. And I'm not resentful of those things, but I do think that it's a good idea that we show queer people as 100% human. And to show someone as 100% human means to show them eating, sleeping, and breathing. And of course, by eating, sleeping, and breathing, I mean living their life to the fullest and experiencing joy, experiencing pain, experiencing love, experiencing sex. I think that's a very human thing. Obviously, it is. It's human. We're human. And so those are the moments that I take pride in being able to show. I know that they're rare. I know that people don't necessarily feel like they understand them. I know that there are certain people who don't want to see any of that, and that's fine. And so maybe to those people, I'm risking losing a connection with somebody who doesn't want to know anything about me anyway. But is that really a risk? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Like, you use the word, you know, taking pride in what you're doing and what you're showing, who you are. And, you know, taking pride is such like an important part of the queer experience and being queer. Ideally, like, that's just something that we all can feel.
Yeah. And so I don't think it's really a risk at all. A risk is definitely going out on a limb, doing something that you don't know. There's so much uncertainty that surrounds the action when we're talking about a risk. But when we're talking about showing love, it's not a risk.
So tell me about, like, what's coming next. I know, like, different pieces of the album and the project are going to be unveiled over time. So, you know, this week is basically part one, right?
Part one is this week. Part two and three come in 2021. I don't have a date for those yet, but we are working on them, and I'm excited for people to hear them. But, I mean, I don't want people to focus on the middle or the end before even hearing the beginning, right? I'm excited about that. We also, as I said, we have this short film that currently is in post-production, so people will be able to see the album come to life, sort of the way I lived it. And then, and there's a couple more music videos that are coming out with the album. In addition to that, I'm really excited. For the first time, we are printing vinyl copies of the album. And so they'll be later. They're down the sort of a second wave. They're not coming. Everything's not happening on the same day. But they will be available. They're sort of collector's editions. And so they'll be available in a few months. And people can invest in that experience ahead of time, which we're crowdfunding, you know, to get the first round printed. Also, in addition to that, I have a live performance. I'm not sure when people will be able to hear our conversation, but there's a live performance at the end of the month that is basically my concert version, Zoom style performance of some of the music selections from the album. And then also some interviews and some kind of exclusive moments with people who helped bring the project to life. My co-star in the movie, people who have sang on the album and featured Leith Ashley, who's a wonderful trans advocate, actor, and model, and singer, sings with me on one of the songs in the album, so he'll be there. And that's on the 24th, 5 p.m. Eastern, on my Twitch channel. In addition to that, I'm also, we have a new, and, you know, voting is right around the corner, and so I've already done it, by the way, but if you're in the States and voting, then you no doubt know that there's an election. And Bob the Drag Queen and myself have decided to come up with our own, to help out the post office, opening our own branch called The Most Office. And we have a music video telling everybody all about it, how they can vote, how they can participate in the process. And that actually drops tomorrow. And it's going to be on our joint channel called Black Queer Town Hall, which was an event that we threw over the summer to have conversations, during the protests, conversations on race and gender. And so now our next project is The Most Office, which we have this music video and a whole initiative going out to inform people about voting, particularly in Pennsylvania, which we want to turn blue, turn back to blue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so those are some of just a few of the upcoming projects that I have going on.
All right. You are busy.
You better believe it.
And so folks can find you on Twitch and Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all those, you know, and YouTube, like you're all over the internet.
That's the truth. Peppermint247.
And now I know, like, it's a weird time for like live performance, but like, are you looking forward to like whenever it actually, the day comes that you can get back on stage and get back in front of crowds?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly miss it, you know. I definitely think I'm 100% sort of really paying a close attention to COVID and everything that's happening. Living in New York City, that would be difficult to not do. And I understand the sacrifices that a lot of people have had to make. So I'm definitely one that wants to be more careful. I believe that COVID is very much still a part of the story of 2020. I'm not necessarily in a rush to get out there, but I certainly do miss it. And I think that when we're able to do it the right way, the safest way, then I'll be the first one to do it.
And in the meantime, you're gathering folks around you online, kind of like the neighborhood kids watching The Wizard of Oz together.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Peppermint, thanks so much for joining me. It's such a pleasure to chat with you.
It was so great to talk to you, and I really do appreciate the time.
Thanks again to Peppermint for joining me, and don't forget to check out all of her numerous projects right now, from the album to the music video to the live streams. And I have one more recommendation this week, Divas for Democracy, United We Slay. It's an online variety show featuring luminaries from stage and screen on Sunday, October 18th. From the drag community, you can expect to see former Sewers guest Alaska, as well as Britta Filter, Sutton Lee Foster, and Jinx Monsoon. And from Broadway, there's Allison Janney, Cheetah Rivera, Cheyenne Jackson, and Cyndi Lauper. Tickets are pay what you can, starting at $5, and the whole thing is a get-out-the-vote show reminding everyone to take part in the upcoming election, while also showcasing some incredible talent. So that's coming up on October 18th, 2020. Just search for Divas for Democracy, United We Slay. Thanks again for listening to the show, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbound to support The Sewers of Paris and get some rewards for backers. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And join us for the next live stream on October 24th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise for detailed explorations of queer milestones from TV and film. The theme song for the Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of thecontact.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.